Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer, and it is my privilege to serve as a minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Christy Anderson, our commission lay leader who is serving as our worship associate this morning. We are glad to be together today and glad to welcome you to this religious community, a community that seeks to celebrate and to serve. I'd like to extend a special welcome to those of you who are with us for the first time this morning. We're always delighted to have guests at our services and hope that if you visit us again, you'll come a bit early as we hold our social hour between our first and second services beginning at approximately 10:30 a.m. If you find that you would like more information about the life and work of this community, I encourage you to complete a guest card, which you can find in the racks and the pews in front of you. You may place your completed card in the offering basket when it comes to you later in the service, or hand it to our representative of our membership committee, who would be glad to greet you at the visitor's table after the service. You can find that table just around the corner outside the sanctuary doors. Ours is a church that strives to practice the fragile art of hospitality. And so in that spirit, I invite you to take a moment to turn and greet your neighbors. In addition to asking you to silence your cell phones, I would like to direct your attention to the thread from the web, that is the insert in your order of service. There you will find several announcements as well as a calendar of events for the week ahead in the church. I would like to remind you that our annual voting meeting to consider the budget for our next fiscal year and our slate of officers will be held today after this service, and I encourage all members of the congregation to stay and participate in that important meeting. Afterwards, I understand the folks who serve our end-of-the-month pancake breakfast are staying to have a second seating, so if you stay for the meeting, you can stay afterwards and have pancakes together downstairs. Next week, you are again invited to join us for worship at 9:30 and 11:15. I will be leading the service accompanied by Worship Associate Ted Vanida. The title of the sermon is Teaching for Life. At the end of today's service, Christy and I would be glad to greet you at the rear of the sanctuary. And once again, I bid you welcome.
In this soft, beautiful, early summer, with the trees so freshly green, and our gardens newly planted, expectant and waiting, we give thanks for the many unknown blessings already on their way.
This first spring in our new house has been delightful. The highlight was my recent discovery in the corner of my yard, my favorite flower, peonies. Peony flowers start as small, tight buds that belie the incredible beauty and magic inside. With nature's nurturing warmth and sunshine, the tiny bud bursts open and reveals a dramatic display consisting of layers of beautiful petals. We've arrived here today somewhat like a bud, tightly bound up by life's stresses. May the support and fellowship that you find in this caring community nurture your inner magic so that your magnificence blooms forth. Come, let us worship together. I invite you to rise and join in singing our opening hymn, number 368, in your gray hymnal, Now Let Us Sing.
Each time we gather for worship, we set aside time to widen the caring ministry of this congregation. We take time to memorialize those who have died, to celebrate with those who are joyous, and to call into this community of care those we know who need our very real love and support. This morning, we join in celebration with the Teeley and Haynes family. Silas Teeley was born May 25th to Brandon and Colleen Teeley. Colleen is the daughter of Becky Haynes. Mother and child are doing well. And now I invite you to name the people who come on your hearts and minds this morning, the ones you want to memorialize, the ones you want to celebrate, and the ones you want to call into this community of care. For all the names which have been spoken aloud and those whispered only in the silent sanctuary of our hearts, we give our grateful thanks. And I invite you to join with me now in the spirit of prayer. Creative spirit of life, open our hearts and kindle our imaginations. This is the world that we have been given, terrible and beautiful, filled with moments tough and tender. Let us embrace them all and find a way to add a touch of color, a note of passion, a stroke of beauty. Let us find a way to make our lives a part of this creation, creator and created, so that together we may walk forward in the ways of beauty and justice. May it be so, and amen.
During the 19th century, American society and its religious institutions were changing dramatically. Overall church attendance was rising significantly, yet men in urban areas were dropping out of church in significant numbers. There were new areas of interest competing for the attention of men: the formation of political parties and labor associations, a growing sense of nationalism resulting from massive waves of immigration, and a war. Men had new avenues for transformative experiences besides religion. The resulting so-called feminization of Protestant religion was a dynamic two-way phenomenon. In order to increase church attendance, male ministers altered their messages and styles to attract women. The women, in turn, were also influencing church practices as a result of their growing leadership in charity work and children's religious education. For the first time, Bibles were readily available to every household. The need for ministers to have the sole responsibility for imparting scriptures was diminishing. As a result, churches evolved into roles more pastoral and socially active. Ministers who maintained the traditional style of eloquent theologians, appealing to an intellectual elite, became the minority compared to those ministers marketing messages of fear and hope, appealing to the masses with common language, stories, songs, and in some denominations, large emotional revivals. Over the course of 100 years, the perception of God transformed from that of a wrathful, authoritarian figure to one of a loving parent. Ministers lost substantial political clout in matters that didn't pertain to religion, and churches lost a disproportionate number of men in attendance at worship and serving as lay leaders. Between the rising role of women, the astute marketing practices of evangelical ministers, and the surge of immigrants practicing non-Christian religions, the face of traditional male-dominated Protestant religion in America was changed forever. These trends continue today. In the 1900s, Gallup polls surveying the religious beliefs and practices of Americans found significant differences between men and women. The 2/3 of the women reported that religion plays a significant role in their life, whereas fewer than half of the men were in agreement with that statement. Women are more likely to believe in God and value prayer. Within Christian congregations, women comprise 60% of those attending, and men comprise 40%. Women outnumber men in every Christian denomination without exception. However, the gender ratios do vary based on the extent of orthodoxy of the denomination. The more evangelical the denomination, the higher the rate of male participation. Religion sociologist Linda Woodhead analyzed gender differences based on categorizing world religion into three varieties. First, religions of difference, which are those worshiping a strong supernatural power separate from humans. Second, religions of spirituality, which are those emphasizing the finding of truth within oneself. And third, religions of humanity, those finding meaning in relationships between people. Men outnumber women in the first two religious groups, religions that profess a strong authoritative God, such as Islam, and the second, religions emphasizing personal enlightenment, such as Buddhism. Religions that emphasize relationship, which include liberal Christian, Reformed Judaism, and Unitarian Universalism, attract more women. This finding is consistent with trends in Unitary Universalism. Looking at UU ministers by gender, the percentage of male practicing ministers is less than half and is declining. In 1978, Unitarian Universalism became the first denomination having more females than males enrolled in its seminary schools. Today, about 65% of students in our two theological schools are women. Is this gender trend a reason for celebration, a cause for concern, or perhaps both?
This reading comes from Neil Chethick, who is a leader in an emerging Unitarian Universalist men's movement and the author of the book Voicemail. The 8-year-old boy was puzzled. In his first years of Sunday school at the First Unitarian Congregation of Ottawa, Ontario, he'd surely noticed the attention paid to women's rights. But on this morning, the feminist message was especially robust. It was International Women's Day, after all, and his teachers were impassioned as they led students in naming women leaders, women heroes, and the court cases that had brought equal rights to Canadian women. Finally, the puzzled boy spoke his mind. "This feminism stuff is interesting," he told his teachers, "but when are we going to have a class on boyism?" 8-year-olds are not the only Unitarian Universalist asking questions about gender and religious education. In a movement where just over half the female is clergy, where a great majority of religious educators are women, and where feminism is embedded in the principles, parents and education leaders are for the first time wondering aloud if boys are getting what they need from the church schools they attend. "The boys are bored with the material," they say. "They're acting out inappropriately. They're speaking out in class. What should we do with the boys?" Our hymn of affirmation is number 23 in your hymnal, "Bring Many Names." I think I was feeling conservative when I settled on the relatively neutral gender and church as the title of this sermon. Having read much recently on the matter, I've been impressed by the titles others have chosen for their books, essays, and sermons. The reading today came from an article evocatively titled, "What Should We Do with the Boys?" Other evocative titles I have scanned include "The Vanishing Male," "The Missing Men," "Where Are the Men?" "Bring a Man Sunday," and the downright provocative "Why Men Hate Going to Church," and "The Church Impotent, the Feminization of Christianity." The spate of publishing suggests that there is either brand new interest in the subject of boys and men and their relationship to religion, or, as one critic suggests, simply a new wave of interest in the subject. I would have been inclined to lead toward the former interpretation until I began my study a couple of weeks ago. I was surprised to learn that concerns about the differences in men's and women's participation in church have a long history. Consider this remark uttered in 1692 by the Puritan clergyman Cotton Mather. So still, there are far more godly women in the world than there are men, and our church communions give us a little demonstration of it. In the mid-19th century, Congregationalist, Unitarian, Universalist, and Episcopal clergymen in New England spoke frequently about the preponderance of women among their members. In his 1890 essay, the Congregationalist minister Howard Allen Bridgman wrote an essay entitled, "Have We a Religion for Men?" He began by quipping that the women naturally gravitate to the prayer meeting and men as naturally to the penitentiary. And then he went on to present his serious concern about the gender imbalance in the Christian churches of the time. In recent years, the demographics of church membership have been carefully studied. Christy gave us a picture of the gendered landscape of religion with the contemporary statistics she shared earlier in the service. The data now confirms what church observers before us have long noted. More women than men actively participate in Western religious traditions. I was curious about how our own community here at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent compared with the norm, so I did a little informal analysis. There are approximately 300 adults listed in our newest directory, which was published a couple of weeks ago. I went through and counted up everyone, noting whether I believe that person to identify as a man or as a woman. Additionally, I marked those who I also know identify as transgender. According to my count, 63% of the people named in our directory are women, 36% are men, and less than 1% are transgender. Now, it's possible I may have counted a few people inaccurately, possible that they would self-identify their gender differently than the one I assigned. But even if a few people chose to identify their gender differently, it's clear that more women than men participate in our congregation. So while I was at it, I decided to count up the children. Of the 109 children listed in our directory, 54% are girls and 46% are boys. Looking at each name, though, I was aware that though most of the parents' children were listed, not all of those kids and youth participate in our religious education program. I think it would be worthwhile for us to do some analysis of participation rates in religious education by gender to see what we might learn about how our own religious education program is tending the spirits of boys and young men. Okay, so the dynamic has been observed, but why is it so? Anne Douglas was one of the first contemporary scholars to venture an answer. Using a socio-historical approach, Douglas traces the feminization of American culture to liberal Christian ministers and mothers in the 19th century in New England. She argues that as the social status of liberal clergy diminished in society, middle-class liberal women were simultaneously seeking spheres in which they could exert influence. Douglas makes an argument that these women found literary, educational, and religious spheres most amenable to their moral influence, and as a result, she says, the church and its clergy were feminized. Now, it's important to remember that almost all the religious leaders, the ministers, religious educators, and lay leaders, were men at the time. Douglas's argument is that those men became feminized themselves in response to the feminine influence of their majority female congregations. David Murrow agrees with that conclusion, though he gets there by a very different route. Murrow is an evangelical Christian and the author of the controversial book, Why Men Hate Going to Church. His approach is based on a mix of the psychology of sex differences and garden variety stereotyping. He argues that male ministers have contributed to the problem by deferring to women and their feminine influence, which has alienated men from church. Murrow believes that by emphasizing safety and harmony, churches turn off men who are looking for adventure and action. He also suggests that by favoring music and worship focusing on the love and sacrifice of Jesus, Christian churches fail to connect with men who want to identify with strength and achievement. Now, Murrow's work is the work of a reformer. He is not rejecting Christianity, but rather calling for dramatic renewal within Christianity in order to make more room for men and masculinity. Elizabeth Cornwell, who teaches in the psychology department at the University of Colorado, offers yet another perspective on the subject. She argues that many of the differences between men and women can be traced to the effects of hormones on our bodies and our brains. Taking an evolutionary approach, she says that the social roles of men and women evolved in direct relationship to the physical differences between the sexes. As the bearer of children, she says, women have long required the safety and security of the social group. This, she believes, explains why women are more drawn to religious community than men. Women's psychology has evolved to rely on intimate social groupings, and it's easy to find these in religious community. Now, unlike Morrow, Cornwell's bias is against religion. She concludes her article with encouragement for women to abandon the tyranny of religion, which she understands to be based on folly and illusion. One more perspective from Linda Woodhead, who's the sociologist of religion who Christie's work drew on earlier in the service. Woodhead argues that it would be more helpful to understand what has been called the feminization of religion through the lens of relationship. She says that modern religions, both liberal and conservative, take as their sphere the development of relationship and activities of care, intimacy, and nurture. Citing a recent study, she notes that a majority of people say that community and social connections are among the most important parts of their religious experience. Woodhead argues that this is true for both men and women and may become increasingly true as gender roles become more fluid. My own perspective is that there's probably a kernel of truth in each of these ways of understanding the dynamic. It makes sense to me that 18th and 19th century white American women saw their churches as one of the few places they could claim power and exercise leadership. I buy that an overemphasis on safety and harmony, love and sacrifice turns off some men, but I think it also turns off some women. I acknowledge that there are biological differences between men and women which may, on average, influence our psychology. And I can see in my own preaching and religious leadership that I emphasize building relationships and an ethic of interdependence. To these factors influencing women's greater participation in church, I would also add the power of socialization. To me, it seems plain that boys and girls are socialized to accept norms of masculinity and femininity, even when those norms don't reflect their own preferences and interests. The three waves of the women's movement have cracked open assumptions and expectations about what it means to be female. Movements for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender liberation have challenged gendered assumptions, including the assumption that there are only two genders. And recent men's movements have begun to call attention to the ways in which traditional norms of masculinity can confine and inhibit men's full expression of their spiritual lives and their humanity. I think these movements have been healthy for people and good for society. I believe it's part of the church's work to encourage and equip all people to live whole lives, which means supporting human liberation movements. The church has a role to play in challenging gendered boxes that are too small. And at the same time, I believe that at this moment in history, the church, by which I mean Unitarian Universalism specific in general and our church in particular, has a special obligation to boys and to men. Whatever the reason, it seems plain to me that men are not being fully served by the church. The members of the Unitarian Universalist Men's Network agree. Founded in 2003, the Unitarian Universalist Men's Network was created to build and sustain a mature, liberal religious masculinity. A big part of their work involves creating resources specifically designed to support men's personal and spiritual growth. They have excellent suggestions and resources for men who want to create meaningful men's retreats and supportive men's groups. As I understand it, a men's group was created here in our congregation several years ago, which initially drew a couple dozen men, but today that men's group has dwindled to just a few members, which meets only sporadically. Do we need to try it again to create a group for men? And if so, what would we need to do differently this time around? This is a conversation I think we ought to have. Another part of the work of the UU Men's Network is equipping congregations to recognize and serve the unique needs of boys and men. Many of their resources describe steps congregations to take to make their religious education programs more boy-friendly. They suggest, and I agree, that boys and girls need male teachers and advisors in their classes. And yet, in many congregations, ours included, many, many more women than men volunteer to fill those roles. The Men's Network suggests designating 50% of the spots for religious education teachers and advisors for men. One congregation that tried this found that the spots for women filled up first, and they actually had to turn away women and recruit men. Though that may seem a bit awkward, sometimes it takes a bit of awkwardness in order to change dynamics that have long been in place. Neil Chethick, the author whose work I used earlier in the service, was and who was the former president of the Men's Network, also suggests incorporating more sports into religious education, as well as competitive exercises that can help boys and girls explore the wisdom of the body and learn to win and to lose well. Now, I don't have all the answers or even a few of them, but I do have a lot of questions that I think we need to be considering together. How are we doing by the boys in our congregation? Are they getting what they need from their religious education program and from the other programming we offer for kids and families? How are we doing by the men in our congregation? Do we need to offer more programming specifically for men or modify any of our existing programs to reflect men's needs and concerns? How are we responding to the unique needs of gay men in our congregation? Do men who visit us on a Sunday morning feel welcome here? Can they imagine themselves easily finding a way to be a part of this religious community? And once a part, can they imagine themselves easily finding a place among leadership that's often dominated by women? I want us to ask these questions and carefully consider our answers because I believe we need one another. On average, men and women are different, and our differences can be a source of strength. Our power lies in mutual respect. Our wisdom comes from seeking to understand. Our future depends on our ability to join together in common cause to build the world we dream. We are dedicated here to the development of souls. Male souls, female souls, transgender souls, all souls are welcome here. May it be so. And amen.
I learned at coffee hour that there's a group of men who were inspired by Melissa's sermon and Brad playing the saw and are now talking about forming a musical group with power tools. Would the ushers please come forward? So. So. As we express our gratitude, we mustn't forget the highest appreciation is not to utter words, but to live by them. This is a quote from John F. Kennedy and serves as a reminder that our offering is an opportunity for us to practice gratitude. If you're a guest, we invite you to take a candle from the basket as our gift to you. We look forward to learning more about the gifts that you bring our fellowship. Thank you.
I send you with these words from the Reverend Mark Bellatini. Go in peace. Live simply, gently, at home in yourselves. Act justly. Speak justly. Remember the depth of your own compassion. Forget not your power in the days of your powerlessness. Do not desire to be wealthier than your peers and stint not your hand of charity. Practice forbearance. Speak the truth or speak not. Take care of yourselves as bodies, for you are a good gift. Crave peace for all the people in the world, beginning with yourselves, and go as you go with the dream of that peace alive in your hearts. Amen.